Welcome to North Star Church. At North Star, our desire is to lead people to follow Jesus Christ and not simply go to church, but to be the church. The following message was recorded and produced at our Blacksburg, Virginia campus. You can find more information about North Star, including recent podcasts, news, upcoming events, and so much more at northstarfamily.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy today's message.
We are in the middle of our study of the book of Job, and I have the privilege, by the way, my name is Sean, I'm one of the pastors on staff here, and have the privilege of opening God's word with you, in case you don't know me, or I haven't gotten a chance to meet you yet. So in that vein, why don't you go ahead and open up your Bible to Job chapter 15. Now, we have a Herculean task in front of us this morning. If you guys have heard me preach before, you know I have a tendency to get excited and talk a little fast. I can still preach for 40 to 50 minutes on about, you know, 2-3 verses. This morning, we're going to try to cover Job chapter 15 through 21, okay? So put your listening ears on and listen quickly, because what we're going to try to do is give you a real quick overview of the passages in front of us. I would encourage you this week to go back and reread through these passages, because although we're going to paint with some really broad brush strokes to be able to say, here's some of the highlights about what's going on, if you'll go back and read it, you'll see that there's some beautiful nuances in each of the speeches and each of the responses and things like that, and you really get a sense for it when you dive into it. Excuse me. We just don't have, I choked on my own spit. That's how coordinated and awesome I am, just for the record. Nothing will humble you like preaching, I promise you. But as we're looking through it, we're gonna try to summarize for us today the second series of speeches that you find in the book of Job. If you're new to the series, or if you're just needing a refresher, let me give you a real quick summary of what's taken place up to this point. The book of Job is the Old Testament account of the life of a guy named Job. And if you're new to church and Christianity, you may make the same mistake I did when I first got a Bible. It's not the book of Job, it is the book of Job, okay? I thought, wow, it's a whole book just about work. Not exactly. This is a book about a guy named Job. Job was a good, godly man who loved his family and had a pretty good amount of wealth. He was one of the most influential men in that area in that day. He was in great shape, in good standing with the Lord, had a great family, and all of these things. Then God allowed Satan to attack Job and to take all of those things from him. In a matter of a very short period of time, he lost all 10 of his children, he lost all of his wealth, and eventually he ended up losing his health as well. In the rest of the book, it tells us about how he responded to the suffering that he endured. We know things that Job didn't, because the first couple chapters tell us that this is all things that God allowed, but Satan was doing. Job doesn't have any perspective that we do on it. But after Job experiences these things, he has three friends who show up. Their names are Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And I know that that is at the top of your baby name list. Don't name them after these guys, especially after their character. First thing they do is they sit there with Job for a full week. Just let Job process, and they're just there. That's the best part of the book, is when they don't say anything. All of a sudden, though, Job speaks out of his pain, and he speaks very raw, very emotional, and is very transparent. His friends decide they know what's going on, and so for a large chunk for the remainder of Job, you have a series of speeches. There's three rounds of speeches that we go through, where one of Job's friends will say something, then Job will respond, then another friend, and then Job will respond. We've been walking through each of those friends in the first series of speeches. But this morning, what we're going to do is we're going to try to summarize that entire second round of speeches, because there is a fair amount of overlap between what's said. Now, I'd encourage you to read it, because one of the things that you need to do as you go through this is feel the weight of this. When we just summarize and get little nuggets, you don't recognize just how painful this would have been for Job, just how grating and irritating his friends are, because you're just getting little snippets of it. But when you read through the whole thing, you sit there and think, my goodness, why will these guys not just shut up? And you understand why Job reacts the way that he does. But as we're going through this morning, if I were to try to put one quick tidy bow on everything that we're going to talk about this morning out of the second series of speeches, it's this. Whenever we encounter suffering, whether we're suffering or we're comforting somebody else who is, we need to make sure that we address suffering with truth. Address suffering with truth. If you've been here for our study, this isn't a new thing for us. We talked in our study of chapters 8 through 10 about how important it is to make sure that we're not letting ourselves be ruled by our feelings and forgetting what's true. We've also seen that Job's friends are misapplying a theology called retribution theology. That's the idea that if bad things are happening to you, it's because you did something bad. They also affirm the opposite, which is, so if you would just do good things, then good things would start happening to you. So all of Job's friends come to Job and say, Job, all of this suffering that you're dealing with is your fault. Obviously, you've done something wrong. But as we know from the rest of the book of Job, Job's sin had nothing to do with the suffering that he was experiencing. This suffering was not as punishment or retribution for what Job had done wrong. This had nothing to do with that. So these guys have been misapplying the truth the whole time. But even as we go through today, we're going to see they are actually just dead wrong all over. So when we go through, we've been talking about this book from kind of three different lenses. We've been talking about what does this teach us about how we come alongside and comfort our friends and our family and those we know when they're suffering. Then we've been looking at the other side of it is, how do I respond to the suffering that I experience as a Christian? How do I deal with the pain and the heartache and the disappointment? How do I address that? The third aspect of that is, what is all of this teaching me about who God is? That's the rubric we're going to use this morning. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a real quick overview. It may not feel quick to you, but it'll be quick, I promise, compared to what it could have been. We'll do a real quick overview of the three friends' speeches. Then we're going to slow down a little bit and look at Job's responses to them. And from that, we'll draw out some truths, okay? So if you're ready to go with me, then let's dive in. We're starting in Job chapter 15, and the first thing that we're going to observe is that when we're comforting somebody, we need to make sure that what we say is accurate. When I'm comforting somebody, I need to make sure that what I say is accurate. In each of the three speeches we're going to look at this morning, the friends start off by rebuking Job and talking about how smart they are. I mean, that's absolutely the way they introduce every single one of these. Those introductions get shorter each time because they're digging their heels in and demanding Job understand that they are correct. After they finish getting onto Job, then they switch and all three of them go into great detail about what happens to wicked people. So when they paint the picture of the punishment that God metes out on the wicked, then it becomes crystal clear that they're saying that reason that Job is suffering is because he has sinned. Okay? Now, that gives you an overview. Let's look at it in the text. Look at the first six verses of chapter 15. This is Eliphaz speaking. I think Eliphaz was, I picture him as a really pompous guy. So I'm going to read it that way. All right? Then Eliphaz the Temanite replied, "Does a wise man answer with empty counsel? Or fill himself with hot east wind? Should he argue with useless talk or with words that serve no good purpose? But you even undermine the fear of God and hinder meditation before him. Your iniquity teaches you what to say, and you choose the language of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, not I. Your own lips testify against you." Now, I don't know what he actually sounded like. Probably nothing like that. But listen to what he's saying. "Job, you're full of hot air." That's how he starts off. Isn't that great? "Job, I know you're in extreme pain, and everything in your life is disordered and disorienting, and you're in a lot of trouble, but you know what? It's obviously your fault." They've been saying that all along, but here's what's interesting. He goes in verse 5, he says, "Your iniquity teaches you what to say, and you choose the language of the crafty." What's he saying? Job, not only have you sinned, he's saying you've gotten so deep into sin that your sin is even changing the way you talk, and that's what's causing you to defend yourself. You're actually choosing crafty, manipulative language as you go through this speech. That's not very comforting, is it? He says, "Your own mouth condemns you, not I. Your own lips testify against you." He'll go on to say that the wisdom that he speaks is the wisdom of the ancients. So he's saying, look, this is how it's always been. All of the really wise people know that. At no point is he willing to slow down enough and for Eliphaz to realize, hey, maybe I'm missing something here. All he does is continue to double down. Now jump over to Bildad's speech in chapter 18. Look at the first four verses of chapter 18. Then Bildad the Shuhite replied, "How long until you stop talking? Show some sense and then we can talk. Why are we regarded as cattle, as stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself in anger, should the earth be abandoned on your account or a rock be removed from its place? What's he saying? Job, who do you think you are to question us? Now, here's the thing about that. What do we know about Job from the beginning of the book? Job is a wise, godly, gracious man who loved the Lord. These men all seem to be about the same age. Elihu, when he shows up later, seems a little bit younger. But these guys all seem to be about the same age. What right do they have to question Job? Job has asserted his innocence over and over again, but these guys are saying, what right do you have to question us? What right do you have to question Job? He could easily flip the tables around. Immediately then, Bildad goes on and begins to wax eloquent about the fate of the wicked. Zophar, we're not even going to read his right now because all he does, he doesn't even try to address Job. He just launches into his tirade. He's like, I cannot tolerate this foul speech. And then he just goes off and that's it. That's how Zophar handles things. He's just not a great dude. As we're looking at this though, we're seeing that these guys just keep digging in. They think they are the source of wisdom. As you and I are counseling, guys, be very, very careful. If you're helping a friend, you need to come in with a tremendous amount of humility. Now, again, I told you, after Job, they tell him how wrong he is. Each of the friends spends time talking about what happens to wicked people. That's where we're going to see them really double down on this idea of retribution theology. Go back to chapter 15, to Eliphaz's speech. Look, pick up in verse 17. Listen to me, and I will inform you. I will describe what I have seen, what the wise have declared and not concealed that came from the ancestors. Right? Can't you see this guy? Like, imagine, Job, we know, is sitting here. He's got boils and open sores. He's ripped his clothes as a sign of mourning and thrown ash on his head. He looks so pitiful that they couldn't even recognize him when they got there. And here's this guy giving this great oration about the fate of the wicked. So he stands up and he says, verse 19, this is what came to whom alone the land was given. No foreigner passed among them. Verse 20, a wicked person writhes in pain all his days throughout the number of years reserved for the ruthless. Dreadful sounds fill his ears when he is at peace. A robber attacks him. He doesn't believe he'll return from darkness. He is destined for the sword. He wanders about for food, asking, where is it? He knows the day of darkness is at hand. Trouble and distress terrify him, overwhelming him like a king prepared for battle. So he says, what happens? The wicked live in constant fear of their destruction. Their days are empty and restless and all of these kinds of things. Now, here's what's interesting. So far, he's been talking kind of in general terms and not actually talking directly to Job, and he still doesn't. But pick up in verse 27. Eliphaz says, though his face is covered with fat and his waistline bulges with it. Keep in mind, in those days, you had to be rich to be fat. That was a symbol of you had more money than you needed, so you're able to overeat. So, though his face is covered with fat, his waistline bulges with it, he will dwell in ruined cities, in abandoned houses destined to become piles of rubble. He will no longer become rich. His wealth will not endure. His possessions will not increase in the land. He will not escape from the darkness. Flames will wither his shoots. And by the breath of God's mouth, he will depart. Now, here's what's interesting. What happened to Job's kids? Do you remember? Job's kids were all at one of their houses, and a great wind came and reduced the house to rubble. What happened to all of Job's flocks and herds and wealth that he had? It all got taken away. Now, Eliphaz knows exactly what he's doing here. Read it again. He will dwell in ruined cities, in abandoned houses destined to become piles of rubble. He will no longer be rich. His wealth will not endure. His possessions will not increase in the land. He's saying, Job, this is you. You want to know why your kids were buried under a pile of rubble in their house? You want to know why all your flocks and herds got taken away? It's because you're one of these wicked, godless men. And that's what happens to wicked people. Bildad and Zophar repeat similar types of words and talk about how this is because of their ruthlessness of the wicked, the greediness of the wicked. Their downfall will be sudden and severe. They live in terror, in impending doom, waiting for this to happen. They just keep doubling down. Here's how one commentator summed up Eliphaz's approach, which really is all three of them. Eliphaz is so intent on winning the argument with Job that he does not consider that maybe his counsel to Job is wrong. Even if Eliphaz is correct in his view of the situation, instead of digging in his heels, he could have tried to change his approach to Job. But instead, they don't. When you put all three speeches together, you see that according to Job's three friends, wicked people live in constant fear of the sudden downfall that results from their ruthlessness and their greediness. And in their mind, it becomes obvious that Job must be one of these wicked, ruthless, greedy men. How cruel is it to look at a man who considers you a friend and to heap accusation after accusation after accusation against him without ever stopping to question your understanding of the situation? Make sure when you're comforting someone that what you say is accurate so that you're not like these friends. It's no wonder that Job responded the way he did. Look at chapter 16, verses 1 through 5. This is after Eliphaz's speech. Job says, "I have heard many things like these. You are all miserable comforters." That's probably one of the most accurate statements in the whole book. You guys are terrible at this. "Is there no end to your empty words? What provokes you that you continue testifying? If you were in my place, I could also talk like you. I could string words together against you and shake my head at you. Instead, I would encourage you with my mouth, and with consolation from my lips would bring relief." See, Job's like, hey, yeah, if roles were reversed, I could do the exact same thing. I've heard the same stuff you've heard. I know all of what you're saying. I've heard all this before. You guys are miserable comforters because I could do the same thing to you. But if the shoe was on the other foot, if the roles were reversed, I would speak comfort and consolation and say, guys, I'm so sorry that this has happened to you. I would listen to you when you tell me I haven't done anything wrong to deserve this. See, make sure what you say is accurate. You say, well, but Sean, what if I'm talking to somebody and I just know that this is what's going on? Aren't I supposed to speak the truth in love? Absolutely. Ephesians tells us very clearly that we are to speak the truth in love. Here's the problem with what Job's friends were doing. What they were speaking was neither true, nor did they love him. So sometimes we can be real clear about, like, I'm going to just pound this truth, man. Like, I'm standing on this. And you recognize after the fact that, you know what? You misread the situation, and you didn't say it out of a desire to love that person. You said it because you wanted to be proven right. These guys at no point were willing to slow down and say, you know what? Maybe we've missed it. Maybe there's something going on here. They were wrong in two main ways. They were wrong because this assumption that we talked about with retribution theology, that suffering is always a result of sin and blessing is a result of righteousness. They were wrong with that assumption because that's a mix of that retribution and prosperity theology that we've mentioned. By the way, if you want an easier term for that, think about it in terms of karma, right? Karma is actually an Eastern religion concept that has to do with like reincarnation and things like that. But in American culture, we use it to describe that dude that cut you off in traffic that you get to laugh at because he got pulled over about a mile later. You know what I'm talking about? Like the guy that was a real jerk to the cashier who then trips and drops his whole Chipotle bowl all over the floor. You know, we're like, dude, that's karma right there. Because he did something bad, so something bad happened to him. Now, we apply it to the guy that's the jerk in traffic. But if we're not careful, we also apply it to that guy that was mean to us at work who's now got cancer. Our sweet mate who was an absolute jerk who's now going through a terrible breakup. So that's what happens. Do bad things happen. Now, they were wrong because that's not what's happening here. Job's sin had nothing to do with his suffering. So let's be real careful before we start talking about the why. You see, we ask a lot of why questions. Jeff's addressed this in an earlier message. We ask, why did this happen? Why does this person? We don't know. I mean, let's be real honest here. We do not know why things happen the way they do. God is God, and we don't know why he allows certain things to take place. So when I'm comforting somebody, I need to make sure that I'm being real clear about what's accurate. See, here's the other problem with the retribution theology. Not only are they misapplying it, we do know that God does punish sin and he does reward righteousness, but what they also had wrong was the timeline where that takes place. See, in their view, this always happens during a person's lifetime. But we have to be willing to acknowledge that we may not see the punishment of the wicked or the reward of the righteous in this life. We recognize that after a person dies, they stand before God and their works are judged. And that's where it all gets made right. See, Job is really clear about this in his response in chapter 21. He points out something that's really interesting. So far, we've said they're misapplying this idea to Job. But here's where we find out that actually this idea is just dead wrong. This idea of retribution theology, and they're, especially the way they're espousing it in these speeches, is just flat out wrong. Look at chapter 21, verse 7. So if all of this is true that you guys are saying, that the wicked are always in terror and all this kind of stuff, then verse 7, why do the wicked continue to live, growing old and becoming powerful? Their children are established while they're still alive and their descendants before their eyes. Their homes are secure and free of fear. No rod from God strikes them. Their bulls breed without fail. Their cows calve and do not miscarry. They let their little ones run around like lambs. The children skip about, singing to the tambourine and lyre and rejoicing of the sound of the flute. They spend their days in prosperity and go down to Sheol in peace. Have you guys noticed that? Sometimes really good people die. And sometimes really wicked people seem to live super easy lives and they die rich, fat, and happy, surrounded by family. Job's willing to say, guys, you're saying this is how life works. If I'm suffering, I must have sinned. What about all of these guys who, like, their sin is obvious? Why are they still living? Why are they still okay? Why do good people die? I think about a man named Tim Shelton. Tim Shelton was the singles minister at Bellevue Baptist Church, the church I had the privilege of interning at when I was in seminary. Tim did my premarriage counseling. He has a wonderful family. I think there's like, I don't know, they kept having kids. There's like at least five or six of them. Tim did our premarriage counseling to set us on a great track in the 18 years of our marriage. He was taking care of his health and doing wonderful things. So much so that he actually qualified to run an Ironman triathlon. Last year, at 51 years of age, Tim Shelton went into the water for the Ironman triathlon, had a cardiac event, and never recovered and died. A minister of the gospel with a young family at home who loved Jesus, doing a good, healthy thing, and he died. Why did Tim Shelton die? I don't know. Why are you enduring what you're enduring? I don't know. Why isn't God stopping this? I don't know. So when I go to counsel you, I'm not a professional counselor by any means, but when I sit down with you to bring comfort, you may very well hear me say, I don't know. Because if I'm going to comfort somebody, and if you're going to come alongside and comfort somebody, make sure what you say is accurate. Job gets fed up with it. In the end of chapter 21 there, he finally just says, guys, how can you offer me such futile comfort? Your answers are deceptive. Verse 34, he says, guys, you're just flat out lying. You're just wrong. How can I take any comfort in that? So when you're comforting, make sure that what you say is accurate. Now, so far, this has not been a very hope-filled message, right? So far, what I'm telling you is that suffering seems absurd. That sometimes wicked people seem to get away with murder, and godly people suffer. What comfort is there in that? Let's draw that out of Job's responses. So when we're comforting someone, make sure what you say is accurate. Number two, when you're suffering, ground your frustration in truth. Ground your frustration in truth. So we know it isn't true. Suffering isn't always a result of sin. Righteousness doesn't always make life easier. What is true then? Well, Job's going to wrestle with that throughout his responses to his friend's speeches. So we've already looked at that last reply. Let's go back to chapter 16 and pick this one up. We looked at the first few verses, but listen to how Job describes his suffering. And if you can, if you're an empathetic person, feel this for a minute. Like, actually put yourself in Job's shoes. Listen to the pain that he's describing here. Verse 6 of chapter 16. If I speak, my suffering is not relieved. If I hold back, does any of it leave me? Now, he's going to go back and forth. You're going to hear him say, he and you. In both of those, he's talking to God or about God. So here he goes, verse 7. Surely he has now exhausted me. You've devastated my entire family. You've shriveled me up. It's become a witness. My frailty rises up against me and testifies to my face. His anger tears at me and he harasses me. He gnashes his teeth at me. My enemy pierces me with his eyes. They open their mouths against me and strike my cheeks with contempt. They join themselves together against me. God hands me over to the unjust. He throws me to the wicked. He's worn out from his suffering. Now, he's not speaking the truth here. Because what we know going on behind the scenes is that God is not the one who did these things. Satan is the one who has attacked him. But Job doesn't know what's going on. In his pain, he is hurting, he is disoriented, he is afraid, he is confused, he is exhausted and worn out. But there's a turn. Pick up verse 18. Earth, do not cover my blood. May my cry for help find no resting place. Verse 19. Even now, my witness is in heaven. And my advocate is in the heights. My friends scoff at me as I weep before God. I wish that someone might argue for a man with God, just as anyone would for a friend. For only a few years will pass before I go the way of no return. He says, look, I don't know how much longer I've got till I die. I'm crying against the earth to remember who I am and what I've done. But here's what I know. I have an advocate in the heavens. Look at it again. Verse 19, even now my witness is in heaven and my advocate in the heights. He said, guys, you are accusing me of all of these things, but you don't have the final say. The final say rests with my advocate who is in the heavens right now. Well, who could that be? Who's the one that could vindicate Job? Well, given the context, God himself is the one who will vindicate Job. Now, look at those two passages in context. He just said, God, you've done this to me. You've done this to me. You've hurt me. You've shattered me. You've caused me to be an outcast. You've handed me over to unjust people. And yet, I know that you're my advocate. I know I have an advocate in the heavens. He sees and he knows, and I'm clinging to that with all that I have left. Belcher comments, there are times when Job sees God as his enemy, but there are increasing instances as we go through the book where Job responds with confidence that he will be vindicated by God. Job is affirming genuine confidence in God regardless of the way it appears God is treating him. Whoa! What did God tell Satan about Job at the very beginning? Do you remember? He said, there's nobody else on earth like my servant Job. Satan said, he only serves you and honors you because you've done all of this. You've given him all these good things. Take that away and I bet you he'll curse you. What is Job doing? He says, I have no idea. I don't understand why I feel like God's treating me this way, why it feels like he's turned his hand against me. I don't understand, but I know who God is. And I'm going to cling on to that with everything I have left. It's the same thing that Jeremiah does in the book of Lamentations. For you to look at this afternoon, we don't have time to dive into it this morning, but put down Lamentations chapter 3. Lamentations 3, he's going to use the same kind of language that Job does. And then right smack in the middle of the chapter, you see him grounding himself to the fact that the Lord's loving kindness indeed never ceases. His mercies are new every morning, and great is his faithfulness. You see, when you and I are suffering, what we need to do is, yes, we experience all of these things. We feel all of these emotions. We process through all of that. And yet, at the same time, we hold on to the truth. In our disorientation, we take that frustration and we hold on to the truth of knowing who God is. He does it again in his response to Bildad in chapter 19. Flip over to chapter 19, verse 23. I wish that my words were written down, that they were recorded on a scroll, or they were inscribed in stone forever by an iron stylus and lead. He's saying, I wish somebody would write this down, write down my defense, so that after I'm dead and gone, people could see it and say, you know what? Job was right. Then he goes on to say this, verse 25, but I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the end he will stand on the dust. Even after my skin has been destroyed, yet I will see God in my flesh. I will see him myself. My eyes will look at him, and not as a stranger. My heart longs within me. Now, guys, we got to be careful, because we know the rest of the New Testament, for those of us who have been walking with Jesus for a while. We know what's also involved in what Job says. But keep in mind, here he's talking about, I know that I have an advocate who lives. Both while I'm here, and then he talks a lot about what will happen after he dies here. He says, my advocate lives now and will live long after I'm gone. So who is that? Again, God himself. My Redeemer lives, and I know that he will stand on the dust. Likely what he's referring to is the dust of his own bones and body after it's decayed. He says, I know that my Redeemer will stand on my grave and be able to say, Job was right the whole time. But what's interesting is he says, I will see him myself. Job had confidence. Remember, Job may have been one of the earliest stories we have. He may have been a contemporary of Abraham. He didn't know all that we know about what life with God looks like and what eternal life looks like and what happens after we die. He didn't know all of that. He was putting his faith and trust in God in ways that we don't have to, because we see it. We know it. There was stuff he just didn't understand. But he knows somehow, even after his flesh is destroyed, he will see God. And here's what's really cool about this. He said, I will see him myself. My eyes will look at him, and not as a stranger. He is so disoriented that you would think, man, it must feel like God is a stranger to you at this point. He's not answering your prayers. You're suffering all of this stuff. He seems so distant. But keep in mind, we've been talking about, this is a series of months in Job's life. We don't know how old he is. He's old enough to have adult kids, so he's not young, right? He's been around for a long time. And so what he's doing here is he's looking back at all of those years of walking with God, looking at all of the history of the things that God has done, all the spiritual markers of the times God's worked, all of the things he knows about him, and says, you know what? When I look at God, I don't understand what's going on right here, but I'm going to see him, and he's not going to be a stranger to me. And I'm not a stranger to him. Because this is the God I know, the God who loves me. In the midst of all of his friends saying, God, Job, you are worthless, you are ruthless, you are greedy, you are wicked, and that's why this is happening. Job says, you know what? God knows the truth. In the moment where he says, I don't understand anything that's going on in my life, but I do know this. I have a Redeemer and an advocate who lives, and I'm going to see him one day. When we're suffering, you may feel like Job this morning. You may be right there in your disorientation, in your fear, in your frustration. Ground it in truth. This is what we know to be true. Let's drive it home a little bit. We've talked about, if you're comforting somebody, make sure that you're accurate in what you say. When you're suffering, make sure that you hold on to that truth even in the midst of your disorientation, your frustration, all of those things. What is that truth? Third thing, in everything, rest in the work of Christ. See, Job was 100% accurate in what he said. But he didn't know the full beauty of the words that he was uttering when he said, I know my Redeemer lives. Now, the Holy Spirit knew what God's plan was to redeem humanity. Job didn't. And so when he penned these words, God knew what he was doing. Now, those of us who live now and can look back at what Jesus did, see the beauty that Job only saw hints of. See, like all of us, Job was born with a heart turned inward and turned away from God. He did what he wanted to do instead of what God called him and created him to do, and the Bible says that that's sin, just like all of us. Job didn't need to just be proven innocent in regards to his suffering. He needed to be redeemed from his sin. And the way that God would accomplish that is by sending Jesus, his son, to take on flesh, to walk on the dust, and to die in our place. You see, Jesus was mistreated far worse than Job. Jesus was maligned. Jesus was accused by those who should have been friends. And yet Jesus had never sinned. He went to the cross and he died. And as he died, he paid the penalty and the punishment for all of our sin. After he died, 3 days later, he rose from the grave to show that the penalty had been paid. And now, in joy, Jesus is calling you to follow him, to surrender to him, to walk with him all of the days of your life. You see, here's what we're resting in. Whether I'm comforting or whether I'm suffering, I rest in the fact that no matter what I see around me, the truth I can always anchor my heart into is that God loved me so much to send Jesus to die in my place and be raised from the dead to give me new life. And I may be completely disoriented and confused by everything else that I see around me, but I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that God loved me because he settled that for me on the cross. You see, in everything we rest in the work of Christ. When suffering hits, we hold tightly to the fact that God has shown forever that he loved us by sending Jesus to the cross and giving us his life. Instead of heaping on guilt and shame, we point our suffering friends back to the work that Jesus has done on their behalf and remind them of his goodness to help them find hope again. That's the truth. That's what we seek to point out whenever we encounter suffering. So I don't know where you are this morning. Are you suffering? If so, run to Christ. Are you comforting a friend? In love, gently and graciously, remind them of all that Christ has done. There's an old song that I don't really like and I always thought was weird. It's by a guy named Bebo Norman, which most of you guys are probably too young to have even ever heard of him, and that's okay. He was like a B or C list Christian artist back in the like early 2000s. But he wrote a song talking about when faith is hard to find, you can borrow mine. I always thought that was a really weird phrase until I started walking with people dealing with genuine pain. There are some days you want to believe. You know you need to believe. But man, faith is hard to find. In those days, that's where God puts us in a body of Christ so that somebody else can come alongside us and say, hey, till you find your own, you can borrow my faith. I believe God is good. I believe God is loving and is gracious and is merciful and is kind. And I believe he forever settled that discussion by dying in my place. And you may have a hard time holding on to that today, but I'm going to believe it for you if I can. Now, I can't save you. I can't believe in your place, but I can support you by believing with you. What do you need to do today in response? How do you need to anchor your heart back in what Christ has done? I'm going to invite the worship team to come back up. And as they do, what I want you to do is spend these next few moments as we sing, as we give, remembering what Christ has done, letting the reality of who Jesus is saturate your heart and your soul so that you're ready to comfort, ready to suffer, ready just to go through the doldrums of life, ready to anchor it in truth.
We're so glad you found this message today. You can find more resources, including previous podcasts, at northstarfamily.org. Thanks again for listening, and we hope to see you next time at North Star Church.